Good morning, folks. This is Ed Lopez, and I'd like to welcome you to our second in our series of six webinars for the Office of Persons with Developmental Disabilities. And this session today will be on the SSDI work incentives. As you know, last week's session was on the SSI work incentives. Over the next 2 months, we will be conducting four more webinars. One on the Medicaid buy-in for working people with disabilities. One on the plan for achieving self-support. And two on the overpayment program. One being just an overview session, and the second one being a session teaching you how to complete the waiver of overpayment or change of rate of repayment form. So folks, at this point, I want to introduce Nicole Sudo. Nicole, who's a wonderful advocate herself, was going to introduce the first session and the program itself, but she had a family emergency last week, but she is here with us today. And Nicole, let me hand it over to you.
Thanks, Edwin. I'm so happy to be on the call and the webinar presentation today. As you said, this is such an important topic for people to learn about, and we're glad to be able to sponsor this in collaboration with Cornell and the Medicaid Infrastructure Grant. So we do appreciate the funding that the Medicaid Infrastructure Grant has provided us in order to present this information to you. To introduce myself, my name is Nicole Sudo, and I work with Supported Employment Programs at the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities, and I'd like to personally welcome you to our Benefits and Planning and Work Incentives webinar series. We have a lot of exciting topics planned throughout the next 2 months, and so we hope if you find this one valuable that you will also continue to participate in the future webinars. And I would also like to thank our presenters today. We have Ed Lopez Soto and Ray Cibula from Cornell's Employment and Disability Institute. I have to say, in my experience, I've found both Ed and Ray to be very well-informed and very passionate about advocating for people so that they have the information they need to make the right choices for themselves about working, and that they understand how this will impact the benefits that they use to get the supports and services that they need every day. So we're really glad to have such highly recognized experts here to share with us their knowledge and expertise on this important subject. So I know there's a lot of information to cover, and I want you to have an opportunity to ask all the questions that you have as you listen to the presentation. So I'm going to turn it back to Ed and Ray so we can get started. Thanks.
Nicole, that was wonderful. I don't know whether to say thank you or to blush, but that was wonderful. And my friends, I just want to remind you that we encourage questions during our webinar presentations. As you know, on the right-hand side of your screen is a control panel, and there's a questions icon there. And if you want to ask a question, just click on the icon, type it in, and send to all, and we will get to it as we go through. In the unlikely event that we don't cover all the questions while we are on the webinar, Ray and I will compile any additional questions, put in the question, put in an answer, and send it to everyone who has signed up for this program. But I really don't foresee that happening, because we schedule these webinars to build in enough time to allow you to ask questions so that we get to those questions that you really want to know about. So my friends, I'm going to get us started right now, and we're going to get going with the nitty-gritty of the work incentives. And remember, this is the Social Security Disability Insurance Program we're talking about, okay? The Social Security Disability Program. This is the program where, in order to collect benefits, you must, and this is key, you must have had an earnings record, or you must have be collecting on the earnings record of someone else, typically a parent, okay? The Social Security Disability Insurance Program. And the first work incentive that I would like to talk about with respect to the Social Security Disability Insurance Program is the trial work period. And this is a wonderful, wonderful work incentive. Now, put yourself in the position of a consumer. And we'll say that this consumer's name is Ed Lopez. And Ed Lopez has had a good work history. But for those of you who know Ed Lopez, you also know that he is an avid cyclist. And Ed Lopez has been hit by a truck. And if he gets hit by a truck, Ed Lopez is going to qualify for benefits because he's got a very, very, very good earnings record. So if he qualifies for disability benefits, once he's on benefits, Ed Lopez does not want to sit at home. He wants to be a productive member of society, like all our consumers, all our beneficiaries want to be. They don't want to be at home. They want to be working. They want to feel valued by someone else. They want value for themselves. And in this case, Ed Lopez does too. So Ed Lopez goes to a benefit specialist and says, "What happens if I go to work?" And lo and behold, this is where the work incentive comes in beautifully. Because for a 9-month period, Ed Lopez can go out and he can earn as much as he wants. And he will still get his full disability check. Now, you heard what I just said, a 9-month period. But it's not just a 9-month period in 9 consecutive months. What they say is, look, we understand that individuals with disabilities sometimes do not go back to work and work 9 straight months. So what they say is, in any, the year 2011, in any month in which you earn over $720 a month, and that's the gross pay, we will say that you have used up one of your trial work months. So if Ed Lopez goes to work that first month and he earns $750, he'll have used up one of his trial work period months, but Ed Lopez will still get his full Social Security disability check. Now the second month, he winds up making $3,000 in that month. Well, in that month, despite the fact that he made $3,000, because it's during the trial work period, he gets his full Social Security disability check anyway. If Ed Lopez made $10,000 in the third month, despite it being $10,000, which is a lot of money, he would still get to keep his Social Security disability check. And in any month in which he was earning over $720 in that month, they would count that month as one trial work period month. So we're looking at a 9-month period, 9 months of trial work period that have to fall within 60 months, within 5 years, before the full trial work period phase ends. So that's how that first phase works. Now we're going to go on to our second phase, and that second phase begins immediately the month after the trial work period. The month after the trial work period. So let me tell you how this works. It's now December of 2011, and Ed Lopez uses up his 9th month of trial work period in December of 2011. January of 2012 is his first month in the EPE, extended period of eligibility. And his extended period of eligibility runs continuously for the next 36 months. So if his extended period of eligibility begins in January of 2012, then his extended period of eligibility ends in December of 2014, exactly 36 months after. And then let me give you the rule of thumb here, because the rule of thumb is very important. And it works as follows. In any month during these 36 months that Ed Lopez's countable, and that's a key word there, countable earned income is less than the substantial gainful activity level, a term of art that we will get to in about a minute, but in the year 2011, it's $1,000, he will continue to receive his full Social Security disability insurance check. In any month in which his countable income is over $1,000, he will not be entitled to an SSDI check at all, because the SSDI program is all or nothing. You either get a full check or you get no check. There is no in between. But there's always an exception in the Social Security world. And that exception applies as follows. The first time during the extended period of eligibility that Ed Lopez earns above the substantial gainful activity level on a sustained basis, he will have what's known as a grace period. And that basically means that there will be 3 months during which Ed Lopez, despite having earned above the substantial gainful activity level, will continue to receive his SSDI check. After that, anytime the countable income is over, no check. In any month the countable income is under, he gets a full SSDI check. So I want to do a little summary here before I move on. Okay, first, trial work period, 9 months. Remember, earnings 720 or more in 2011 over a 60-month period. Okay, and so during that period, despite earnings being much higher than 720, a person like Ed Lopez will continue to receive his Social Security disability check, the full check. Once the trial work period is over, the month after, you've got a new phase, what we call phase two, and that's the extended period of eligibility, 36 consecutive months. If Ed Lopez never has countable earnings above the SGA, during those months, Ed Lopez will continue to get his full check the whole time. If Ed Lopez has earnings that go above the SGA, countable earnings above the SGA, he will have a grace period. And those first 3 months, and they're consecutive, you notice it says right there, allows the person to receive a check for that month and for two more months. That's the grace period. They're consecutive, that grace period. He will then start after that, either getting a full check or not, depending on the earnings. Now, let me move us along here.
Okay, Ed, we have a question for you.
Absolutely.
And somebody's asking, does the earnings amount in the trial work period ever increase?
Absolutely. That's a great question, by the way. The answer is that, in fact, the earnings amount in the trial work period, when I started doing this kind of work, was $75. And then it went up to $200. And then it went up to $530. This year it's $720, and next year it will still be $720. But it does increase depending on the national wage index and the cost of living adjustment. It's a great question. And if you stay tuned to our website at nymakesworkpay.org, or you look at the OPWDD website, we will list when the substantial gainful activity increases, we will list when the trial work period levels increase, we will list Medicare premiums, etc. Great question, Ray.
Yeah, and Ed, one more thing I just wanted to add to that. Because most of the work we do is done retrospectively, it's going to be important to remember that if somebody was working in 2008, that you go to the Social Security website and find the trial work period that applied during that year. You can't use current figures when we're looking to past years.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. Thank you, Ray, for reminding us of that. And this is why we have two people doing this training all the time, because we're listening to each other and we are able to, you know, come in with new ideas and answer questions for you. So thanks for the question, and Ray, thanks for the comments. The last thing I wanted to cover about phase two is to remind you, because people often say to me, if I'm reporting on a regular basis and my earnings were to go above the SGA, when can I expect that to be applied to my check? Well, let me remind everybody that Social Security's Disability Insurance Program works as follows. Your check that you receive in December is for November. It's not for December. It's for the month before. So if you report earnings by the end of 1 month, typically the Social Security Administration will adjust the SSDI for the following month. So I always say that we're usually going to be paid 1 month behind if the Social Security worker is inputting everything into the computer and if all the reporting is being done. And that's why it's incredibly important that individuals that go to work begin to report. And I understand completely that sometimes Social Security will say to an individual, don't bother reporting, your earnings are not high enough for it to make a difference. Okay? And let me tell you, I understand that that's easier for Social Security, but sometimes we want to remind the people that we work with, an individual who's working, who's on SSDI, that we want to get them into the habit of reporting. So we'll often say to them, report it anyway, because this way they get in the habit of reporting it, and you know that down the road, that might be the way to avert an overpayment. And now, Ray, we are ready to get to our first polling question, and I'm going to run it, and I'm going to launch it here, and here's the question. Ray, would you read the question for us?
Sure, Ed. During the extended period of eligibility, depending on your countable earnings, it's an easy on, easy off process without reapplying for benefits. One more time, during the EPE, depending upon your countable earnings, it's an easy on, easy off process without reapplying. True or false? Please make your selection. Hit submit.
That's right. And let me tell you, we've got already 50% of you have voted in 38 seconds. And let me, well, as you're voting, let me tell you why we have these polling questions in here. The polling questions help us understand whether everyone has gotten what we've said or whether we've actually been clear in the point we wanted to emphasize. And so the polling questions are a way of making sure that we're covering the material that we want and that people understand it. And if there's a lot of people getting the wrong answer, then we go back and we re-explain it, because obviously we've not done a good job with it. And right now we've got a minute in. I'm going to close the poll. We had 90% of you voting, which is wonderful. Let me share the results. And the results are quite good. 80% of you said absolutely true. It is an easy on, easy off process, and there is no need to reapply. It's automatic. And that's the correct answer. And 20% of you said false. And I think the reason people sometimes think it's false is because they assume that, yes, it's automatic, but they still have to report, and they still have to make sure that the Social Security Administration claims representative is actually putting it into the computer. And that's absolutely correct, because even though it is an easy on, easy off process, it's got to be in the computer or it doesn't happen. Right, Ray?
I think so. I think when people see easy and Social Security in the same line, they have to say false.
Absolutely. But you know, it really is an easy on, easy off, and we don't see too many problems with this at all, just so you know. Oh, here we go. Okay, here we are. Substantial gainful activity. Remember that I said to you about 10 minutes ago that I'd be covering substantial gainful activity. And if you look at that first bullet on your screen now, you'll notice that SSA looks at countable gross earned income. And we're going to spend a bit of time discussing what countable gross earned income is over a set amount each month. And I said to you that currently in the year 2011, that set amount is $1,000 a month for all SSDI recipients who are not legally blind. It's going to be $1,010 in 2012. So that individual who asked a question before about whether the trial work period went up, and I said yes, and I also said so will the SGA. Well, the SGA, the substantial gainful activity level amount, is going to be going up in 2012. In 2011, the set amount for a person who is considered legally blind or statutorily blind is $1,640, and it's going to be $1,690 in 2012. And I'm often asked at training sessions, why is there a disparity between the SGA amount for a person who is not legally blind but disabled and the person who is disabled because of blindness? And the answer is that, my friends, the legally blind community has had a very good lobby over the years. And many, many, many years ago, they convinced the Social Security Administration to, in fact, begin increasing the SGA amount for a person who was legally blind every year based on the cost of living adjustment and national wage index combined. And so because that's been going on for a while, the amounts are higher. And because the amounts are higher, if you have a 2% increase of 1,000 versus a 2% increase of 1,640, you notice that it's going to be even more disparate over the years. And you know, that's just the way it works. And now, before I get into what countable gross earned income is all about, though, I do want to take us to the second polling question. Get us going right away. And the second polling question is as follows, and I'll launch it in a second. SSDI always looks at gross wages. You cannot reduce these wages in any way. Okay? That's, and this question is designed to make sure that I see how many of you know the answer to this question before I even get to discuss it. So again, the question is, SSDI always looks at gross wages, okay? Always looks at gross wages. So, Ray, do you see the question there?
Yes, I do.
Perfect, perfect. Okay. Oh, and this is another one that people are voting very fast. I'm going to tell you, you folks are really engaged, and I love it. I love the fact that folks are paying attention and they're responding to these questions right away. We've got over 80% of the questions being answered already and votes being done. And listen, I want this to be a much higher percentage. Those of you who have not voted yet, vote. Even if you're not sure, I'd like to see where people stand. So please vote if you can, because that way I will know what's going on here. All right. I am now, oh, perfect. Hey, I did spur at least two more of you to vote, so that's great. Let me close the poll, and let me share the results. 25% of you said true. Social Security always looks at gross income. You can't reduce the earnings at all. But 75% of you said false. And Ray, would you tell us what the answer is and why?
Yeah, I'm going to go with the audience in that 75%, because gross wages is where we start. And as Ed said, we use gross wages for trial work. But if Social Security was not allowing any reduction from gross wages, the webinar would be over.
Ray, you are too clever, absolutely too clever for words. And I'm going to remind everybody before I move from this slide, okay, and as I hide the polling results, okay, have the polling results disappeared?
No, they have not.
Okay, let me do it again then. They should, yep, they've disappeared now. Okay.
They have
not. Yep, remind everybody that I've bolded four words in that first bullet, countable gross earned income. And you notice that it doesn't just say gross earned income, it says countable gross earned income. And right now, we're going to get into what countable gross earned income is going to be all about. So let me start off by saying to you that the SSDI world always looks at monthly wages when they are earned. And that's really important here. When they are earned, not when they are received. If you remember at last week's webinar, I explained to you that in the SSI world, wages are counted when received. In the SSDI world, wages are counted when they are earned. And let me give you an example right away. Let's take the example of Roger, who happens to be paid on September 4th. for the two-week period ending August 29th. His gross earnings for that period were $500. Well, my friends, for SGA purposes, the $500 is counted in August because it was earned in August. That pay that he got on September 4th was for August 16th through the end of August, for the time in which Roger worked. So this is one of my first hints to you in this program. Whenever you are analyzing earnings under the substantial gainful activity rule, you've got to actually go back and review the earnings on a day-to-day basis to make sure that you're just counting the earnings that are made in the month in which they worked. Okay? So you have to make sure that you do that. And that, my friends, is somebody's phone that just went off. I apologize for that. So always very important. Now, let me just also tell you that nowadays, in most places, what you have is individuals who are paid 24 times a year, twice a month. And this is very helpful to us because when they're paid 24 times a year, twice a month, the first paycheck in the month is for the 1st through the 15th. And the second one is for the 16th through the end of the month. And we don't have that kind of a problem. But if people are still being paid instead of twice a month, 24 times a year, once every 2 weeks, 26 times a year, that's when you have to go back and ensure that you count the number of work days and the hours, and that you do a calculation for the month that's individualized for your consumer to see whether they really engaged in substantial gainful activity or not. So that's the first hint that I want to give you. Now, remember that I said to you that there are ways to reduce the gross income before you get to the quote, countable substantial gainful activity level? Well, here are the three that we're going to be covering in the next 45 minutes. First, paid time off. And by paid time off, I mean vacation, personal days, holiday time, and sick pay. None of those is counted because you're not at the office working. You're not providing a service. The second topic we want to cover is impairment-related work expenses. And that is expenses that are actually incurred by the individual for an item that they need because of their impairment and in order to work. And we're going to cover all these in a lot of details. And the third is subsidies. And that means that something that is provided by somebody else, either an employer or another agency to help the person be able to work. So we're going to be covering these three in quite a bit of detail over the next 45 minutes. Now let's cover the first one, deductions for paid time off. Remember, paid time off includes, as I said, vacation, it includes personal, it includes holiday, and it includes sick pay time. And what's wonderful about most pay stubs now is that if you were to look at a pay stub, you'll notice that there's a gross amount listed. And then you'll notice that the taxes are taken out. And the taxes count for gross wages. That doesn't get reduced. But you'll also notice underneath that if the person has taken a sick day, it'll say sick time paid. If they've taken holiday, it'll say holiday time paid. If it's a personal day, it'll say personal time pay, and the amount will be right there, right there. And so that's really important that you keep track, because if the person's taking vacation time, personal time, holiday, or their sick pay, guess what? That amount comes right off the top. So that's just the way it works. It comes right off the top, and it is deducted from the gross pay to determine, oh, the countable wages that we mentioned before. The countable wages. So it's extremely important that you keep that in mind. Now let me give you an example to sort of highlight how this works. And the example is going to involve Darlene. And she's earning $1,040 gross per month. And as you know, in the year 2011, $1,040 is above the substantial gainful activity level. So if there was nothing that we can do to reduce her countable gross earned income, if she was in her EPE, extended period of eligibility, and already used up her grace period time, she would not be entitled to a check. But look what happens in her case. It's December, and she receives $40 in holiday pay for Christmas Day. She also receives $20 in holiday pay for Christmas Eve and $20 for New Year's Eve. Her countable wages for December are being reduced by $40 plus $20 plus $20, $80. So you go from $1,040, which was above the SGA level in 2011, to $960, which is below the SGA level in 2011. And that, my friends, is how paid time off works. It's the same for sick pay. It is the same for vacation pay. And Ray, I'm going to move the slide, and it's your turn.
Okay, we have one question for you, Ed, related to that last slide. Somebody Perfect. Wants to know, what about bonuses received by employee? Does the bonus count as income?
Well, it all depends on whether the bonus is considered a bonus for everybody in the office, or if the bonus is just being done because of your of what you actually provided to the employer. And there are so many different rules, and Social Security has come up with different rules for people who work for Walmart and get bonuses, etc. And my answer to you is that if you have a bonus issue, that you contact me at ejl44@cornell.edu. You describe the bonus to me, and I'll be able to tell you whether it counts or not. Okay, Ray?
All right. Thank you, Ed. We're moving into impairment-related work expenses. Now, these are a very, very powerful way to reduce that gross income that's received to what Ed mentioned as countable gross income. And we're using IRWIs in the Title II situation to reduce wages below SGA. Because if wages are below SGA, who really cares about reducing them for countability purposes? So what we have to look at is the term IRWI. And notice it's an impairment-related work expense. So the first thing we need is an impairment. Now, you know and I know that not many people who are receiving Social Security disability insurance benefits have one impairment. There may be one impairment that was the basis of their disability, but this says impairment-related work expenses. So what we need to do is make sure that Social Security is aware of all of our clients' impairments, regardless of how minimal they may be. And once Social Security is aware of an impairment for which the recipient is receiving treatment from a physician, impairment-related work expenses are going to dramatically increase. Now, the three-part test, it's a very simple three-part test. Does the individual with a disability pay for the item or service? An IRWI is an out-of-pocket expense to a worker for the cost of working. It has to be paid by that individual without reimbursement from anyone. So in my situation, when I take my blood pressure medication, I have an impairment. I receive treatment for it. What do I pay for? I have health insurance, so I pay for the copay. I pay $10 a month for that medicine. That is not reimbursed, so that would be my IRWI. If I did not have health insurance and those pills cost $180 a month and I was not reimbursed, $180 a month would be my IRWI. Is the item or service related to an impairment that's on the person's record? They have to be impairments of record. So not only do I have high blood pressure, but I also have high cholesterol. So before I go to bed, I take a pill for that too. But if I received benefits because of my high blood pressure and never told Social Security about my cholesterol issue, the copay that I pay for that pill that I take at night would not count. So it's up to the recipient to inform Social Security as their health situation changes and as their medications change and the costs go up or down. The last requirement is, do you need the item or service to work? Well, let's look at my impairments. High blood pressure, high cholesterol. Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious to most people that I need those medications in order to work. So if I answer yes to those three questions, I have an IRWI, and the cost of that IRWI is deducted. Now, Ed gave you an example of the unpaid work time that turned on what? $41, if I remember. And we had $80. Any copay, any amount that your clients are paying for impairment-related work expenses is going to be critically important, because we are really looking for every dollar, every cent to get us below that current SGA month amount. And remember, just like trial work, the SGA amount is changing as well. So if we're looking at 2008, we need to figure out what was SGA in 2008. That last bullet on the bottom, remember that Social Security must approve all of the IRWIs? They do, but they don't approve them prospectively. That doesn't mean we don't report them. We provide Social Security with a list of items and a list of expenses. And when my income reaches $1,050, oh, he's over SGA now. Is there any evidence of IRWIs in here? Yep, there's a list. It's $150 long. I'm going to look at the first $50, and that's all I need. That's how this is happening. If my income goes up to $1,200 and my list of IRWIs ends at $150, I'm still performing SGA. So it's going to be very important that Social Security has way too much information. This is when TMI is a good thing. Make sure those are reported. Here's some samples. Now, these samples are right out of the Social Security manual. This is a non-inclusive list because I want you to spread wide. I want you to expand your mind and reach for the stars here. There is almost no limitation on IRWIs. But some of the easy things here, supported employment services. If the person who is working is paying for that employment support, it costs money. It's an IRWI. Attendant care services. Somebody has to pay to have a nurse come up to the work site to feed them via a feeding tube or to administer IV drugs during the workday. That's an attendant care cost. PCA costs, personal care attendant costs. Transportation costs, that's going to be a little bit tricky, but there are times when people need specialized transportation. Medical devices, work equipment and assistance. Now, if you think about work-related equipment and assistance, you're probably thinking, well, the ADA requires that the employer buy it. Well, that's a true thing. But what if I buy JAWS or Dragon Dictate and put it on my home computer so I can do a little bit of work at home? Or I just come to work with a special chair that I know is going to meet my needs. The cost of that chair is work-related equipment that was paid for. Residential modifications, if I can't get my wheelchair through the front door, I can't go to work. So the ramp, the widening of the door, bathroom modifications, we're going to stop at bathroom. I'm not going to allow you to modify your kitchen, but you got to get into the bathroom or you're not going to be able to work. So some residential modifications. We're talking about some big-ticket items here, too. So we're going to talk about what to do with these big-ticket items. Routine drugs and medical services, diagnostic procedures, and look at non-medical appliances and devices. Remember those OTC things, all those over-the-counter drugs. that your client might use. Your client may very well have some drug that is very upsetting to their stomach and digestive system. So as a result, they're taking Tums to counteract that, or some other over-the-counter medication to counteract the impact, you know, the side effect of the medication. Drag that in as an expense as well. So we want all of those expenses and anything related to them. So I think I want to talk, Ed, about the residential modifications again. When we're talking about a big ticket item, you know, I'm going to say anything over $300 or $400, there is the potential of amortizing the expense over 12 months. Now, clearly, if I put in a $6,000 ramp at my home, I don't want a $6,000 IRWI in 1 month. But a $500 IRWI for 12 months, that sounds pretty good. That sounds pretty good. And when we're talking about the $300 or $400 item, it's really dependent upon the individual circumstances. Maybe I do want it in 1 month, but maybe I want to consider dividing it. Also for some of these items, you know, we're talking electric wheelchairs. We're talking some really expensive equipment. Now, if Ed's my benefits planner and I tell him I am just really uncomfortable, I know what you're telling me and I understand it and it makes sense, but I really don't feel comfortable losing my cash benefits right now. I just need that safety net for a little bit more time till I know I'm going to be able to work. Well, an electric wheelchair is a very big expense, and I can amortize it over a year. Will a year give me enough time to get comfortable? And if I'm not sure, maybe we want to discuss the possibility of renting the wheelchair rather than purchasing it. Because then we rent a wheelchair, have a $400 or a $500 IRWI for a 3-year period of time, and just like a car, at the end of the rental period, you get a new one. You know, so these IRWIs can be allowed not only to get somebody off, to keep somebody on benefits for a while, but to allow somebody to get off of benefits and achieve independence at their own pace and comfort level. So these are critically important things.
Right.
And they're very pliable.
Right, Ray, yeah. I'm just going to jump in for a minute and just remind individuals that in so many cases, parents think that they're being helpful by paying for a wheelchair. And I've had 3 or 4 individuals in my offices over the years who have said to me, well, you know, I mean, Sally has a wheelchair and we're paying $400 a month. And I say, well, why are you paying it instead of Sally? And they'll say, oh, because Sally can't really afford it. And I'll say, but if Sally doesn't pay for the wheelchair, she'll be losing her $800 in SSDI benefits. But if she's paying for the wheelchair herself, her countable earnings will be below the SGA level. She'll keep her SSDI check of $800, thereby being better off. And you can use that $400 for something else, for Sally. And people like will smack themselves in the head and say, oh my goodness, why did nobody ever tell me? Why is this the best kept secret? And it shouldn't be. And that's why you're here, and you'll be going out and letting people know that this is one way of using IRWIs. And Ray, we have a great question from one of the participants. And the question is as follows. Let's take an individual who lives outside of the city limits, and they utilize someone to bring them to and from work due to the impairment. How would you report the transportation cost if there is no receipt?
Ah, well, you know, that is a great question. And the first thing I want to mention is that, you know, when I said transportation, I said it could be tricky. But the scenario that was presented is a really good thing. We're outside the city limits. There's no public transportation. And because of the disability, this person can't drive. So they're hiring somebody, basically, or paying a neighbor to drive them to and from work. It's a very casual relationship. That doesn't mean there can't be a receipt. All a receipt is a piece of scratch paper where I write out, I, Ray Cibula, paid Ed Lopez $5 per day during the month of June for transportation to and from work. During that month, I worked 19 days. That's all that's necessary. So there's not going to be a formal receipt. And if you do, if somebody wants a formal receipt, there's certainly the potential of somebody creating that informal kind of receipt or even a very informal contract.
Absolutely, Ray. And in fact, one thing I want to say, though, is that to make sure that if the person is actually not paying for the transportation, then it's not going to be an IRWI. Because remember those three questions? Needed because of their impairment? Yes. Needed in order to work? Yes. Paid for out of pocket. If there was no payment, it is not going to be an expense. Yep. So there's got to be a payment. And I mentioned that because often neighbors will, out of the goodness of their heart, give people the ride. In that case, if they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart and not getting any money, and the person who's disabled is not paying any money, then it's not going to be an IRWI. Pure and simple. And if you send me an email and you say to me, Ed, is this an IRWI? And it says that the person is not paying for it, I'm going to tell you right away, well, answer the three questions for me. And answer the third one especially. Is it an expense to the individual? If the answer is no, not an IRWI. Simple as that.
Yep. Nice folks and attaboys get you nothing here.
Absolutely.
And we have a great scenario here that Ed put together that discusses transportation. Harry, he earns $1,100 in gross monthly earnings. He's performing SGA in the absence of any deductions. He has CP and uses a cane and cannot walk to the bus stop. That's disability related. Harry pays $150 per month for door-to-door transportation from home to work. Does it meet the three-part test for an IRWI?
And that's the polling question, right?
Oh, well,
How about that? So we're going to get to that one right now. I'm going to launch it. Make sure can you see it yet, Ray?
Yes, I can.
Perfect. So does it meet the three-part? The answer is it meets the three-part test, true, or it does not meet the three-part test, false. And let's see how folks do here. So this is a question to see how much you understood about what we talked about, that three-part test, those three questions that I've talked to you about, because they're three very important questions. And I'm going to tell you, Ray, that as of right now, 30 seconds into it, we have had 70% of the participants already voting, and as of right now, the vote is unanimous.
Yeah, it's looking real good.
It's looking real good, and that doesn't happen very often, does it, Ray?
Very rarely.
Very rarely. So you know, it's always good to see that. And I'm going to give you guys another, come on, a few more vote. If you're not sure, vote anyway. So we get a sense of what the answer is, you know. There's no maybe here. So it's either true or false. And we've got a minute. I'm going to close the poll, and I'm going to share the results with you. And the results are really good. 100% said true, Ray, and 0% said false. So that's a pretty good sign. Would you say that 100% were correct or incorrect here?
You know, Ed, this time I can confidently say everyone got the question right.
All right. So we're in good shape here, right?
Yeah, we're in very good shape.
Great. And now that we know that, I'm going to go through and have Ray actually go through the answer for you one at a time. Go ahead, Ray.
All right. Harry has met that three-part test, as you know. He's paying for the transportation out of his own pocket. There was no indication that he's receiving reimbursement from anybody. He needs the transportation due to his impairment. We said he had CP and he cannot walk to the bus stop. And clearly he needs the transportation to get to and from work. Without the transportation, he's homebound and unable to work. So we meet all three parts of that test. And look at the calculations here. $1,100 gross monthly earnings minus the IRWI, $950. He's not performing SGA. The result is he's entitled to his entire SSDI check. Now, notice there's a step two here. Step two is critically important because we don't want to end by telling Harry your benefits are going to be reduced to $950. We need to point out the end result in order to encourage work. Harry's gross earnings are $1,100. He still receives his SSDI of $650, which brings us up to $1,750. But we have to count that IRWI because he has an expense. So we subtract the $150 IRWI and tell Harry that at the end of the month, he has $1,600. Last month, he only received his $650 DI check. So his financial situation has improved greatly. And in fact, with this 1 month of work, Harry has earned his way out of poverty.
Absolutely correct, Ray. And Ray, we have a great question from the participants here. And the question is there a maximum amount that SSA is going to allow for someone to pay for private transportation from a neighbor? Because the reply that I have always heard is whatever amount is reasonable. And the question I have is, can you elaborate on that whatever amount is reasonable?
You know, I probably could elaborate if I put my mind to it, but you don't want to put your mind to that. You know, you don't want to do that. Whatever is reasonable is appropriate. Now, if I tell you that my neighbor takes me back and forth to work for $5 a day, I'm assuming I work real close to home. You know, if I tell you that I give my neighbor $400 a month to take me to and from work, you know, you're going to start raising some questions. Like, okay, what's going on?
And
well,
eyebrows,
I live 25 miles from my job. So I'm not only paying my neighbor for the gas expense, but a little bit for the wear and tear in the car and a little bit for her time. Okay, that's reasonable. You know, so we're talking about reasonable within the context of that individual situation. And if I told you what reasonable was generally, it would remove your having to look at every single situation within that situation's context. And I don't ever want you to do that. And I don't ever want you to let Social Security do it.
Great. And Ray, let me just tell you something that I found very helpful that was told to me by a Social Security worker whom I adored, who's now retired. And Thelma Gillette was her name. And Thelma said to me at one point, let me tell you what's reasonable for private transportation. What would it cost if the person was hiring a cab? And I say, well, if they had a cab, we'll find out. Oh, it will cost $17 each way. So that's $34 a day. So she said, so if it's less than 34, it's reasonable.
Yep.
And if it's more than 34, it's not. It's the way she put it. I said,
yeah,
oh.
No, I mean, seriously, I mean, we have both had cases where people have had no choice because of their disability but to use cab service because they had to get from door to door. Now, using a cab service is very reasonable, because the alternative is a private car service, and that's going to cost a whole lot more. And you don't need a town car. You just need a cab.
Absolutely.
So let's switch gears here. Now, as I said, an impairment-related work expense is a cost to the employee, a cost to the worker for working. We're changing now to subsidies, and we're looking at subsidies as a cost to the employer for having a person with a disability on the workforce. Now, subsidies also exist for everybody. You know, impairment-related work expenses, we all have. We just don't have benefits to use them to offset against. But subsidies, we also all have. And why I want to reinforce that notion is that a subsidy is a very uncomfortable thing for your working client. You know, our workers with disabilities have every right to take pride in their work effort, just like we do. And when you tell them that they have a subsidy, up springs the notion that you're being paid more than the value of your services. So you're not earning that paycheck. That's something that has to be handled very, very gently, because it's not really encouraging. You need to respect that person has the right to be pleased with themselves. Now, when an employee is paid more than the value of the services, there's a subsidy. You know, what would that be? I work with Ed, and because of a disability, I need to take an hour break every day. You know, I can get through my lunch, that's fine, but in the afternoon, I need an hour break. I just need to go into a room, turn out the lights, and be quiet. But Cornell pays me for that time. I have not provided a service to Cornell. So an hour a day of at my hourly rate is a subsidy. Yeah, so we need to show that everyone has it. So what kind of subsidies do you have at work? Have any of you ever gone for that hour lunch period and come back 15 minutes late? If you have not been docked, you are subsidized. If you snuck out at 4:30, you know, because that daycare center is closing and you got to get there before they charge you extra money, and you were paid for that half hour, it's a subsidy. So we all have them, and I just want to make sure that we treat our clients gently when we're talking about that. There's another type of subsidy here. When an agency is providing extra services to an employee, you know, there are lots of situations where job coaches are involved. And job coaching provides a very, very different type of subsidy. Because if you think about it, most job coaches are provided by a third party, either AccessVR, Goodwill, some private entity is paying that job coach, but it's not the employer and it's not the employee. So we've got to look at that as a legitimate job support, but the question is, what's the value? Can we move to the next slide, Ed?
Absolutely, my friend.
All right, when is there a subsidy? Do these situations all say, yes, there must be a subsidy? No, they don't. But they certainly must raise a red flag in your mind and think, we need to consider the question. So we're talking sheltered employment. There's certainly a subsidy involved. Childhood disabilities. We're talking about a developmental disability that may prevent some sort of activity over the course of someone's life. So we need to consider, is it limiting work at all? Does it eliminate something that they're supposed to do on a job description and somebody else has to step in and do that? A mental impairment? If the amount of pay that the person reports sounds like it's ridiculously high, and that happens a lot more than you would think. You know, there is Eddie. He promised my mom on her deathbed that he would take care of me. You know, and I've got mental retardation, but Eddie is a big-time lawyer up in Rochester and gives me a job for $30,000 a year. And I shred some paper, and I go for coffee, and I sweep the floor. Now, I'm providing valuable services to an employer, so I'm working. But am I providing $30,000 worth? And so that's the issue. Social Security can only charge me with wages that I actually earn. Now, if I allege or somebody else says I'm not earning my pay, so what do I want to do in that situation? After you hear my story, you want to talk to Uncle Eddie. And when Uncle Eddie says, he's my nephew. I promised my sister that I'd take care of him. I never would pay anybody that much money. There isn't even a job in my company that performs these services. We want to talk about that. Again, we want to do it in a way that doesn't minimize the job effort at the same time. The employee gets extra help from others because of the disability. You know, there are four of us that work as a team. And I have dexterity problems, so I work a little bit slower, but we get our work done every day. You know, the employer may not even know, but but the four of us get our job done. So there could be a subsidy there. And anytime we're looking at job training programs that are sponsored by the government or that are particular to people with disabilities, we need to consider that as well. So we can move on, Ed. The wonderful thing about subsidies is that if the employer puts a value on the subsidy, Social Security will accept it. Will accept it. You know, if the employer is unavailable because they won't cooperate with you or because the employee says, do not talk to my employer, then we need to get some form of secondary evidence. So I'd talk, maybe I'll let Ed talk to my team. Or maybe I don't want anybody to know, so all you have is my statement. That will be weighed accordingly by Social Security. Okay, Ed, can we move to the next slide?
Should be up there, Ray.
No, it's not.
It's there here. So you don't see the slide there, right?
I do not see the slide.
Employer subsidy example?
Nope.
Huh.
Well, you know what I can do? I can pull up the slides alternatively, I believe. If we were in the same room, this wouldn't have happened.
Right.
Does anybody else, somebody please write a note and see and let us know what slide you're seeing. Are you seeing slide 17 or slide 18? 17. Everybody else is seeing it, Ed.
Ray, you want to come in here and just do it from here?
No, everybody else is seeing slide 17, too.
No, but I mean, do you want to come into my office and just do it? Hey, Mike, could you move the slides?
Yeah, everything seems to have gone haywire. It's gone now.
It's not here at all? You don't see it?
I'm not seeing anything.
Wow.
Yeah, Ed, I'm not seeing it either.
Bear with us, guys. This is a new one.
Wow, this is like wild because I see mine is working just fine here. So I wonder if it's something having to do with GoToMeetings.
It went right to the final slide. It's as if we checked out already.
That is so bizarre. I mean, I've got... Ray, do you want to pull up the slides on yours, see if it works that way?
I am doing that right now.
It could be GoToMeetings, too, by the way. That is so weird. Because mine, I see my slides clearly. I'm moving them. They're moving very quickly, just like always.
Current slide.
So we are on slide 18, Ray.
We are on slide 18. I've got that up. Now, if Mike, can you change that to change the control to me?
Yes, I just did.
Ah, there goes Mike. Show my screen.
Perfect. And let's see if it works with yours. Beautiful. You're on there. You should be on slide 18, my friend.
All right, now let me get to the right. Now, everybody,
I see it.
Know if I move to slide 18.
Yep, I see it.
All right, I don't want you to see it. I want somebody else to tell me.
Yes, I see it. It's on the
All other right, side. Nicole's got it, so we're back in business, guys. So sorry for that. All right, an employer subsidy. Here, again, we're looking at developing these subsidies to determine the actual value of the work performed. Again, Social Security can only consider wages that are actually earned. And as I indicated, if the employer says, if Uncle Eddie says, Ray is working at a 75% subsidy because I would never hire somebody in that type of position in this business, then Social Security will accept that without question. After that, we need to deal with alternative types of proof that have alternative weights with them. Now, the example we have here, Ed's employer, Empower, drafts a letter detailing the value of Ed's services. Employees doing Ed's job with extra supervision get paid, without the extra supervision, get paid the same as he does, $10 an hour. But his real value is $7.50 an hour because of the extra supports that he receives on the job. All employees get about 3 hours of supervision a week. Ed gets 12. Now, if that extra supervision is related to Ed's disability, there's a subsidy there. The cost to the employer of 9 hours of supervisory time is the value of the services. So once Empower details the values of services, Social Security will accept it, and they'll reduce gross wages to countable wages by that appropriate amount. Now, special conditions. You know, I love the law. I've always been fascinated by the law. If we don't have rules that support a situation, we just make up a new law. And this is involving the job coach. Typically, it's a job coach situation where somebody else, Goodwill, is providing the job coach. Now, we have to acknowledge the fact that there is support. There's an on-the-job support that is being provided. What we do, however, is value it very differently. Notice I said that when the supervisor is being paid by the employer, we look at the supervisor's hourly wage. This situation sees a subsidy that exists that's not a cost to the employer or to the employee. So it doesn't really fit subsidy, and it certainly doesn't fit IRWI. So in order to value that support, what Social Security does is look at the number of hours of support and value that by multiplying it by the employee's hourly wage. So rather than seeing my supervisor's $25 an hour wage being used, we're looking at my $7.15 wage being used. And so be very careful with that. Those job coaches provided by AccessVR, provided by Goodwill or another third-party agency, are still going to be subsidies, but we call them special conditions because the value has changed. Subsidies for people who are self-employed, they exist as well. And, you know, as we get into or try to get out of this recession, self-employment is becoming a bigger and bigger notion for our clients. You know, the fact that they might be able to work out of their home and start their own business. Look at this one, unpaid help. What's that all about? It's a subsidy. You know, we have a colleague whose name is Connie, and her husband is a disabled vet and restores antique homes. So the man's truly an artist, but he's a horrible bookkeeper. He has his own business, and every day Connie makes him take all of the receipts out of his pocket and put them into a basket in their mudroom. Connie then collects all of those receipts and keeps his books for him. So, how do we value that? We have to ask, what does a bookkeeper in the greater Indianapolis area make? 30 bucks an hour? Connie takes 4 hours a week to do his books? That's a $120 subsidy per week. Unpaid help. A business expense not paid for by the individual. AccessVR provides you with a computer, a printer, a wireless router, all of it at no charge. Social Security is going to look at that if you're in a self-employed situation and use the value of that as a subsidy, even though you didn't pay for it. Now, the one warning I want to give you is that self-employment is a world in and of itself. And if you do get into a self-employment situation, I'm going to encourage you to contact Ed and myself because there's much more to this story than that. Now, how do we calculate the effects of a subsidy? We're going to use the job coach intervention here. We need to know the number of hours. Notice it says on site. Then we're going to multiply that by the hourly wage of the worker. What does that tell us? That tells us that a third party's paying. That equals a $100 subsidy per month. If the individual's monthly gross is $1,060 and we subtract $100, we're not performing SGA. And if we're not performing SGA, we're entitled to our entire check. So we have earnings plus our entire Title II check as an end monthly income total.
Absolutely, Ray. And Ray, we have one question that's on point with respect to subsidies that I'd like to cover right now. And that is, if someone goes for a training event that is not paid for by anybody else, like Access VR, etc., can the person claim it as a subsidy?
Well, if it's not paid for by anybody, is that the question, Ed?
Correct.
You know, I think that it's paid for by somebody. The person's not going to this. The person may be getting a tuition waiver or something, but that time, I think, has value. And if it's related to the job and it is providing extra support, I think I would try to find out what the value of it is, and I would try to use it.
But remember, folks, each and every time that you think about subsidies or ERWIs in the SSDI world, we're talking about only needing them if we've got countable earnings that are above the SGA and you want to bring them below the SGA. Otherwise, they're not going to be necessary. And at this point, Ray, I'm going to take us to our last polling question.
Okay.
And it's a fun one. And it reads as follows. If you pay for an item out of pocket, it can also qualify as a subsidy. True or false? If you pay for an item, and do you see it up there, Ray?
I just launched it.
Oh, I launched it. Oh. Well, now it's been unlaunched.
It's closed. Give me just 1 minute and I can get it reloaded.
What
I
happened
didn't
there, Ray?
You were back on.
Yeah, well, you know, it's something's going on with the system.
Yeah, this is an original one. This hasn't happened before.
Never. Well, Mike is putting this info back up. I want to stress a major point here. There's no reason for an individual who's on SSDI benefits not to work and not to report that they are working. I've got to tell you that all too often, I get individuals calling me and saying, I'm working, but I'm working under the table. And I'll say, well, that's fraud. And they'll say, but you know, I'm only working 3 hours a month. And I go, how much are you earning? $400 an hour? And they go, no, I'm earning 10 bucks an hour. And I'll say, well, that's 30 bucks, but my check will be reduced or terminated. And I'll say, no, it won't. That's well below the substantial gainful activity. It's well below the trial work period level. It doesn't even count. And too often, individuals think that if they go to work, that they shouldn't be reporting it because they're going to lose their benefits. And that should not be the case. There is no reason for our individuals with developmental disabilities to not be reporting when they go to work. Absolutely no reason, because as Ray and I will tell you all the time, in most cases, it's not going to make a difference. In fact, almost in 90% of the cases, it's not going to make a difference to the person's SSDI check. And it's going to make the person feel a lot better, and they don't have to worry about down the road about someone reporting them and being accused of committing fraud.
Okay, Ed, it's reloaded.
Great. Okay, Ray? If you pay for an item out of pocket, it can also qualify as a subsidy. True or false? And Ray, do you see the reloaded slide? Ah, here we are. I see it now. true or false. And we've got 4% of you voting so far. Very quickly. We've got 30% of you voting. The numbers are going up instantaneously. And this is a really important one, right, Ray? Because we're going to stress the differences between IRWIS and subsidies as soon as this polling question closes. We've got 70% of you voting, and there's almost a, I'm not going to say 50-50 split, but there is almost a split here. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. So we've got 80% of you voting, perfect. Andrea, I'm going to close the poll, and I am going to share the results. And the results are true. 45% of you said true. If you pay for an item out of pocket, it can also qualify as a subsidy. And 55% of you said false. If you pay for an item out of pocket, it cannot qualify as a subsidy. And Ray, what did we say, true or false here?
Ed, I'm not, I can't see the entire question, so I'm going to leave this to you.
Okay, I will deal with it. The answer is false. A subsidy is provided when the person does not pay for the item out of pocket. And the IRWI is an IRWI when the person needs the item because of their impairment in order to work and they pay for it out of pocket. The big difference between a subsidy is an IRWI is that with an IRWI, the individual is paying for it out of pocket, and with a subsidy, somebody else is covering the cost. That's the big difference here. That, my friends, is that. Now, Ray, do you mind moving the slide up to number 23? And I'm going to take over here. And if you don't mind moving us along here, keep going. I know these are animated, your favorites. Well, remember we talked about two phases so far. We talked about the trial work period, in which a person could earn any amount and keep their full SSDI check. And then we talked about the extended period of eligibility that comes right after the trial work period, the last for 36 months, where the general rule is countable earnings above the SGA, no SSDI check. Countable earnings below the SGA level, you get a full SSDI check, with the one exception being the first time that the individual engages in SGA during the EPE, because then they keep their check for those 3 months, the grace period. But now, let's assume that the person has gone through their entire extended period of eligibility. It's over. And they keep working. And they're earning above the SGA level. At that point, they're actually going to be getting a notice. And that notice is going to say, Dear Ray Cibula, you are a success story. You have gone through your trial work period. You've now used up your EPE. And after the EPE, you've actually engaged in substantial gainful activity. And as a result, we think you're a success story. And so you're no longer going to be getting a check. But, this is important, if within the next 60 months of this termination, you should not be able to engage in substantial gainful activity anymore, you can then come back in and request expedited reinstatement of benefits. So the requirements are as follows. They say, look, when you request expedited reinstatement of benefits, we are not going to make you file a new application. We're going to look at your case from where it is today, and that's a very good thing. And what are we going to ask? We're going to ask you, were you eligible for SSDI benefits? Yes, they were. Did you lose it because you were working at or above the SGA level? Yes, they were. After the EPE engaged in SGA and they sent a congratulations letter out. Are you requesting reinstatement within 60 months? It's got to be within 60 months of that last month when they were entitled to a check after the EPE. Because remember, during the EPE, it's easy on, easy off. So you cannot have your benefits terminated. The congratulations letter cannot go out till after the EPE. And Ray, can you move on to the next slide, my friend?
Yeah, Ed, I have a question that's going back to Irwies, but I want to get it to you before we move too far away. Does the Social Security recipient receive correspondence from SSA indicating the IRWI or subsidy is recognized?
Well, the answer is maybe. In some cases, depends on the claims rep. The claims rep will send out a notice saying, we have received the following letter from you stating that you've got $87 in IRWIs every month, and we are going to grant you $87 a month. And some, there'll be a letter that says $87 is what you requested, $75 is being granted. In some cases, there's no letter received, and we have consumers calling up and saying, so was my IRWI and or subsidy accepted? And then the worker will say, oh yeah, if it hadn't been accepted, you would have known because you wouldn't have gotten an SSDI check. So the answer is maybe, but in most situations, I'd say you need to follow up if you haven't gotten a notice. And Ray, if you don't mind moving up, look at that. Continuing with the requirements. Social Security says, is the individual still disabled by a condition that is the same or related to the physical or mental disability that was the basis for their original claim? And then they say, and are you able to work at the SGA level now? And of course, the person is not performing substantial gainful activity. And if they're not performing it, that's all they look at. And then here's the beauty here. They say, if the individual stops performing SGA and they meet the other EXR criteria, you do not need to show that the termination of work or reduction in hours is related to the individual's disability. So what's the key there? Basically, what you're saying is, I'm requesting expedited reinstatement because I'm a disabled individual and I also am not performing substantial gainful activity. You don't have to say, the reason I'm not performing substantial gainful activity is because of my disability. All right? It's just that you're not performing it. That's very important here. Ray, next slide, my friend. As you know, with the SSDI world, sometimes individuals are married, and so a spouse might be eligible and children might be eligible. And the bottom line is that you can have dependents' benefits reinstated if they meet all of the requirements for entitlement to the benefits. And the reason we say if they meet them and if they meet them now, it's because, as you know, if a person has been getting benefits for a while and then they are successful after the EPE, and then they're out of work for 4 years, their kids might have aged out. And so they might not be entitled to benefits anymore. And so they would not, of course, be reinstated. Another thing that's wonderful about the expedited reinstatement program is that an individual can get provisional benefits for up to 6 months while they're waiting for the reinstatement decision. Okay, and this is pretty incredible. Provisional benefits for the wage earner for 6 months. And let me just tell you that what's beautiful about this is that should the person be told that they're not going to reinstate their benefits, unless there was fraud committed, there's going to be no overpayment. That will be free money to the individual. So if the individual is not committing fraud, and they are at the Social Security Administration office and they're asked if they want provisional benefits pending an EXR determination, expedited reinstatement determination, the answer is always going to be, yes, I want those benefits now. The other amazing thing about the expedited reinstatement period is that if an individual receives 24 expedited reinstatement checks, and that includes the provisional benefits checks, okay, and they don't have to be continuous, because once they're back on expedited reinstatement, it's again easy on, easy off. Countable earnings above the SGA, no check received in that month. Countable earnings below the SGA, a full check received in that month. But once they receive 24 expedited reinstatement checks, and you have to keep track of them, lo and behold, that individual becomes eligible for a new trial work period, for a new extended period of eligibility, and for a new expedited reinstatement period. And that's pretty amazing when you think about that. That is an incredible benefit. And I've been at this now long enough that I know of over 50 individuals that are in their second trial work period or second expedited extended period of eligibility or second even expedited reinstatement period. That's how long we've been at this work nowadays. Ray, next slide, please. Everybody here should know that any individual that's getting SSDI is also going to be entitled to Medicare, and that SSDI recipient is entitled to continued Medicare coverage during the 9-month trial work period and for at least 93 months following the 9th trial work month. So people should not be worried about losing their health care benefits when they go to work, even if they're performing substantial gainful activity. They will still qualify for their health care benefits. They have to pay the premium, but look at what the premium is going to be in 2012, $99.90. That's under $100. And where else can you get health insurance for that little amount of money? That's pretty amazing. So when you look at 93 months after the 9-month trial work period, that typically means that for an SSDI recipient who goes to work, they can keep their Medicare for a minimum of 102 months or almost 9 years, 8.5 years. A phenomenal, an absolutely phenomenal work incentive. Ray, moving to the next slide with the question and answer period here. I want to give you some information. You can always contact our New York Makes Work Pay hotline. The phone number is listed there. It's 1-888-224-3272. And at this point, it will take you through a list of menu items and will ask you what you're calling about, and you press menu items, and then you will get a call back typically within an hour from either Krista McDonald or Jessica Abbott or Marta Santiago at Neighborhood Legal Services. These are incredible experts in their field. So if you have a question, you talk to them. If a person needs a TDD, that's the number there also. And then I do want to close today, before we get to a final question, with the following. I want to remind everybody that work pays in more ways than one can imagine. You have more money in pocket. You start working towards independence. You feel better about yourself. You do better around other people. It's a win-win situation. So I want to encourage folks to please, if possible, please make sure that you encourage individuals with a developmental disabilities to work and to report when they work. And Ray, any other questions that we need to go through?
Yeah, Ed, we want to go through a review of the last slide in the Medicare situation. And can you also give people information about when the webinars will be archived?
Absolutely. Ray, if you don't mind going back to the slide 26 for me, I will cover it again. Okay. The point we're trying to make with this final slide on Medicare is that an SSDI recipient will typically have Medicare benefits. And if the SSDI recipient goes to work, they can continue to receive Medicare benefits, but they need to pay for it because they're paying for it now. It's $99.90 in 2012. And what will happen is if they're not getting benefits because they're performing SGA and it's countable SGA levels, lo and behold, they will be billed on a quarterly basis. 99.90 times 3, which is $299.70 on a quarterly basis that needs to be paid for. They were already paying for it and they'll continue to pay for it. And they will be able to qualify for that Medicare health care benefit for at least almost 9 years, and often more than that. So it is an absolutely wonderful program. With respect to the webinars being archived, every one of our webinar will be archived. And they're all going to be appearing, and you'll be getting a notice about them as soon as they're archived. The first one should be ready in about a week, and this one should be ready in about 2 weeks. So before the next webinar, both of these webinars will be up and archived, and you'll be getting a link so that you can access them whenever you want, should you want to listen to Ray and myself and those dulcet tones once again. Ray, any other questions?
We're all set.
Well, in that case, it's 11:30. Let me thank you for participating. Let me once again encourage folks to encourage individuals with developmental disabilities to work, to not have to worry about the benefits, to report so that there's no fraud involved. And my friends, we will be talking to you again at the beginning of January, on the first Tuesday in January at 10 a.m., when we will be discussing the Medicaid buy-in program for working people with disabilities. Take care and happy holidays.